From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! More than 100 Lebanese refugees are dead following an Israeli attack on a UN post in southern Lebanon. We'll talk to Professor Edward Said.
It's made it quite clear that their aims in Lebanon are far from Hezbollah. I think they're trying to destroy the Lebanese economy. I think they're trying to put pressure on Syria. And I think, obviously, that Peres is trying to win an election.
Today is the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing, considered the worst act of domestic terrorism in U.S. history. We'll look at the government's case against Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols and the presence of right-wing extremist groups in the U.S. military. And Congress sends President Clinton an anti-terrorism bill that many say is anti-democratic.
Mr. Hyde, I'm sure, will admit that there's a provision in this bill that allows the consideration of secret evidence that the defendant will never even know about and can never refute. That is absolutely counter to everything that our country stands for.
That and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. After yesterday's bloodbath in southern Lebanon, in which Israel attacked a UN base, killing more than 100 Lebanese civilians, President Clinton says he's somewhat hopeful that the warring sides will agree to international appeals for a ceasefire as he dispatched Secretary of State Warren Christopher to the Middle East. While Clinton refused to single out Israel for condemnation, in a rare display of unity, Europe recoiled in horror and urged Israel to abandon its Grapes of Wrath blitz on Hezbollah guerrillas. And the Vatican condemned Israel, saying, "There are no political or military reasons which can justify such dramatic consequences." We now turn to Dr. Edward Said, author of Culture and Imperialism. Said served on the Palestine National Council for many years, was born in Jerusalem, and is a professor of comparative literature at Columbia University. Professor Said, welcome. What is your reaction to yesterday's events?
Well, it's pretty predictable. I mean, they have trumpeted, the Israelis, their surgical strikes and their care about civilians and all the rest of it. You know, it's a sort of massive propaganda effort to paper over what in fact they're doing, but it's caught up with them, you know. And I think it's made it quite clear that their aims in Lebanon are far from Hezbollah. I think they're trying to destroy the Lebanese economy. I think they're trying to put pressure on Syria. And I think, obviously, that Peres is trying to win an election. It has very little to do with security or the truth or anything like that. But unfortunately, the story is not only there, but also the incredible powerlessness of the Arabs, who are divided, in the case of Lebanon, hopelessly weak. And in the case of the others, hanging about, waiting for the Americans to do something.
What about the American response? Democracy Now! Is an election show, and we are looking at foreign policy in terms of presidential politics. In fact, we wanted to play for you President Clinton's response last night as he arrived in St. Petersburg, came down the steps of the plane, and talked to the press about what he had learned on the plane.
Today's events make painfully clear the importance of bringing an end to the current violence in Lebanon. To achieve that goal, I call upon all parties to agree to an immediate ceasefire. An end to the fighting is essential to allow our diplomatic efforts to go forward. Resolving the current situation will not only stop human suffering, it will help us all to make further progress toward our goal of a comprehensive and lasting peace in the Middle East.
Your response, Professor Said.
It very carefully avoids mentioning Israel or condemning it in any way. About a year ago, an Israeli reporter wrote an article for the Israeli press in which he said that when he called up the State Department, he wasn't sure whether he was talking to the Israeli Foreign Affairs Ministry or the U.S. State Department. I think this, plus the events of the last two, 3 years, demonstrate that the United States government, with Clinton at its head, are an extension of Israeli foreign policy, not the other way around. The head of the Middle East division of the State Department, a man in charge of policy, Christopher being, you know, sort of permanently on vacation, I mean mental vacation, is a man called Dennis Ross, who is a former employee of the Israeli lobby. And he's surrounded by like-minded people. The United States, and Clinton in particular, feels that it can only move forward in the Middle East with Israel in the front of its sights. And the Israeli agenda has been adopted by the United States in the peace process from the very beginning. So, speaking both as an American and as a Palestinian, as an Arab, you know, I'm of course shocked. But it is the continuing extension of you know, years of U.S. foreign policy in which facts, justice, the possibilities of permanent peace are trampled underfoot as the juggernaut continues, and the Israelis, in what I consider to be an orgy of self-righteous violence, wreak havoc on everything around them. And I think at the core of the whole thing is the Israeli sense that Arabs are contemptible, racially inferior people, and they can be killed with impunity.
Now, of course, what Peres says and what Israeli supporters say is that Israel was responding to these Katyusha rockets that the Hezbollah was firing into northern Israel, and they had done it right next to the UN base in southern Lebanon, and this is why this mistake occurred, that in fact that they were responding, that they were not the aggressor.
Well, that, of course, is a total lie. The fact is that beginning on March the 4th, there have been a series of quite serious Israeli defeats, military defeats by Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Your listeners should know that Israel has been in military occupation, illegal military occupation, of a strip of Lebanese territory in the south of Lebanon on the pretext that Israel was protecting its northern border. In addition, the Israelis have, of course, ravaged the place and have installed a mercenary army called the South Lebanese Army, headed by a cashiered Lebanese officer called Lahad, and have tried to maintain order in this strip. And of course, they have succeeded not at all. The Hezbollah have developed capabilities so that in the last year, for example, no Israeli reporter has been allowed into South Lebanon. The Israeli troops are constantly hunkered down. They can't move out of their fixed positions, and they're constantly harassed by Hezbollah guerrillas, who are described routinely by the New York Times as terrorists and by much of the Western media in the same way, but are seen by nearly everyone else in the world as, in effect, repulsing a foreign occupation, which in fact it is. Israel has made no secret of it, but the press in this country simply mutes it over. And so what really happened was that the Israelis decided that they couldn't win the way they were proceeding. They lost four soldiers on March the 4th. They lost another on March the 10th, all in the occupied in occupied Lebanese territory, not in Israel at all. On March the 14th, five more Israeli soldiers were wounded by Hezbollah. And Hezbollah, I was in Jerusalem at the time. On March the 20th, there was a suicide bomber who killed one Israeli soldier, also in South Lebanon. Then on March the 30th, they came across the border, the Israelis, and decided to uproot Hezbollah, having failed to do so through occupations, through ravagement, and so on. And what they did was a bombing of the south, so deliberately to create 400,000 to 500,000 refugees, which are, of course, terror tactics. I mean, in my opinion, Israel has behaved like a gangster and a terrorist state. I mean, if anywhere there is terrorism to be found, it is in Israel's behavior, which has no regard for human life, especially if it's Arab life, and has proceeded to destroy the south, attack civilians. They've hit ambulances, they've hit hospitals, they've hit schools, they've hit refugee camps, and it all culminated yesterday. It couldn't be hidden. They couldn't say that they were trying to kill Hezbollah, so they killed 105 civilians. You know, Hezbollah is a guerrilla force. It has representatives in the Lebanese parliament. It is rooted in Lebanese love. These are Lebanese people fighting for their own freedom from Israeli military occupation. So literally everything that Israel has said in the last 2 weeks is is in fact a lie, a fiction, invented on grounds, you know, that they are fighting against Islam. And this is legitimized by the Sharm el-Sheikh summit, which was bulldozed into existence by the Americans to give Israel more ammunition to do this. And the ultimate goal, of course, is the election of Peres and the election of Clinton. You know, one could say cynically that that's the way democracies operate. And, of course, in Israel, there's a report today in the Christian Science Monitor, and my son is living on the West Bank, was telling us the same thing, that the war has been carried on Israeli television like the Gulf War. So you've got the impression of surgical strikes. No civilian casualties have been shown. None of the devastations, none of the refugees, and so on and so forth. I think the ultimate goal, of course, one of the other goals, is to destroy the Lebanese economy, which is beginning to come back after 15 or 17 years of civil war, and which poses a threat to Israel's economic domination of the region, and also, in the process, to stick it to Syria, which has been resisting Israeli terms for a peace settlement, terms which are, of course, totally unacceptable, with a very slim hope of any withdrawal by the Israelis from the Golan Heights, occupied since 1967. Israel has also demanded from Syria that it dismantle 60% of its army, withdraw its defenses to the other side of Damascus, withdraw its missiles, etc. And Israel does none of that. So these are the tactics of a state that is, in effect, carried now financially and morally and politically by the United States taxpayer. We subsidize Israel in its, in my opinion, gangster tactics to the tune of approximately $5 to $6 billion a year. So in the face of all this, one asks, you know, what do the words peace and war have to do with reality?
Professor Saeed, starting on Monday, there were Security Council meetings. Madeleine Albright, of course, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. The U.S. prevented a Security Council resolution being passed that mentioned Israel. And even yesterday, an Arab-sponsored U.N. Security Council resolution did not get the number of votes, the 9 votes it needed to pass. And finally, one was passed that did not select out Israel. Can you talk about the role of the United States in the UN Security Council and whether that shifts, whether it's a Democrat in the White House, President Clinton, or whether it was President Bush or before that?
Well, I think the tactics are exactly the same. That is to say, the United States uses the Security Council, uses the United Nations shamelessly to badger, bully, etc., when it wants a resolution. For example, in the case of the Gulf War, to produce a resolution that enables the United States to conduct a war against Iraq. And similarly, or conversely, in the case of the so-called peace process and now the action in Lebanon, the United States prevents any action in the United Nations that might deal with some equity and some justice with conflict in the Middle East. I mean, there's a horrendous double standard here that other invasions are, of course, routinely condemned. But both the Republicans and the Democrats are heavily reliant upon the Jewish vote, as Truman said in 1948, beginning there. Contributors to the Democratic Party, especially Clinton, are over 60% from Jewish sources in this country. And it's playing politics. I mean, there's no secret made of it. You know, he wants the vote, he wants the money, he wants the support.
Do you think that the Jewish vote is monolithic in the United States?
It's treated that way by the administration, by the Democratic Party. I don't think it is, but I mean, I think it's possible to persuade people that there ought to be a distinction made between Jewish Americans who are seriously interested in peace and justice, and those who support Israel, and there is a large number of those who support Israeli policies in the Middle East that are basically belligerent and dominating. But you know, this is the information that I'm referring to here is put out by the Democratic Party. I mean, the importance here of what is considered to be a substantial number of voters, as opposed to the very small number of Arab Americans who don't have anything like the clout on the other side.
in the May issue of The Progressive, you wrote a piece called The Legacy of Sharm el-Sheikh, Declaring War on Islam. Certainly the, quote, anti-terrorist summit in Sharm el-Sheikh that President Clinton attended was very important for him, and even in terms of presidential politics here, a leader in the world against terrorism is really what he looked like standing in Sharm el-Sheikh. Next week, there was supposed to be another anti-terrorism summit that Warren Christopher has now canceled. Why do you call the Sharm el-Sheikh summit a war on Islam?
Well, it's been going on since the end of the Cold War. I think there's a need for a foreign enemy, a foreign devil, a manufactured one, of course. Islam is a religion comprising about a billion people. It has many different currents, many different traditions, languages, and so on. But in the minds of most people who are rushing about and can only watch CNN for, 3 minutes at a time, Islam is a useful catchword for everything that we hate: violence, terrorism, etc. And there's a willing core of so-called experts in this country, scattered through the New York Times, the Council of Foreign Relations, and elsewhere, that purvey their hatred of Islam and their ignorance to the media, because it advances their careers, it makes them appear on television and this sort of thing. And it produces a new industry of Islamic experts and so on and so forth. I mean, it's a convenient label. And to it are attached now all the sort of free-floating animosities and hatreds that were pried loose from the Soviet Union, from our feelings about the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And Islam is, because of its size and because it's so heterogeneous, There's no response to this, really. There can't be. And most of the Arab Islamic states, like Saudi Arabia and to a certain degree Egypt and so on, there's so many internal contradictions. They're basically corrupt oligarchical governments the double standard is widely in evidence. I mean, here, the United States promotes democracy or claims that it promotes democracy around the world, and yet it supports some of the most bloodthirsty, unforgiving, undemocratic regimes in the world, all on the basis of fighting terrorism. And, of course, into this has fed the idiocies and stupidities of small bands of Islamic extremists who have played into it because, they want publicity, they want to exercise their own sort of craziness. And do bloody incidents like the one yesterday in Egypt when 18 tourists were killed in a senseless display of violence. And what you have then is a very easy campaign to manage against this devil called Islam. And terrorism is attached to it now, I think, forever. So that there's no chance to hear the calmer voices, the anti-terrorist Islamic voices, the secular Islamic, etc., the various people in the Islamic world, in the Arab world in particular, who are trying to fight for human rights, for women's rights, for minority rights, and so on and so forth.
Professor Saeed, we only have 1 minute to go, and of course it is the biggest question. What is the solution in Israel, Lebanon, the West Bank, and Gaza?
Well, I don't think there's a solution at hand. I think what we need is two things. Number one, I think the Arabs can no longer deal with the West and Israel, with the United States and Israel, from a position of supplicancy and weakness. They simply get, either bloodied, as they are now getting, or they get these horrendously unfair deals. So there has to be a greater increase in Arab confidence and strength, on the one hand. And number two, I think Israelis and American supporters of Israel have to someday face the fact, which they haven't faced, of what the cost of Israel has been to the Palestinians. And there has to be an understanding, a radical understanding, that the Palestinians are a people. They were destroyed. Their society was taken from them. They were dispossessed in 1948. And they are entitled now to a genuine sovereign existence alongside Israel so that they can live in peace. Without that, you could never have peace. These schemes for buying off and finding a leader like Arafat to sell out his people work in the short run. But the tragedy of the whole thing is that this is deeply bad for the Israeli Jewish citizens who think they're getting a peace but in fact are not. They're buying off for a short time some of the violence and disturbances of the Intifada, but they will surely return.
Professor Saeed, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Edward Saeed, author of Culture and Imperialism. He served on the Palestine National Council, and he's professor of comparative literature at Columbia University. His latest article, Declaring War on Islam, The Legacy of Sharm el-Sheikh, appears in the May issue of the Progressive magazine. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, it's the first anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. We take a look at what happened there, the trial, and also the anti-terrorism bill that just passed. Stay with us. Listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman here in WPFW studios of Pacifica in Washington, and Juan Gonzalez, my co-host, is joining me in New York. Juan, welcome.
Good morning, Amy. And today is the one-year anniversary of the bombing of the Alfred Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, an event which drew national attention to the growing armed anti-government militia movement in the U.S. And we have two guests today. One here in New York is with me, Todd Ensign of Citizen Soldier, a GI veterans rights advocacy organization. And Todd is the author of a forthcoming article in Covert Action Quarterly on right-wing groups within the U.S. military.
And Jim Ridgway is joining me here in Washington. He's a writer for the Village Voice who's been investigating and writing about the evidence against the two accused of orchestrating the Oklahoma bombing, Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh. Jim, why don't we begin with you? What theories are the defense putting forward right now?
Well, the defense is going to use several different ways of trying to shake the government's case. I mean, the first thing is they're going to have witnesses, people who say that McVeigh wasn't where he was at the times where the government says he was. There'll be all different kinds of people who will begin to question whether Tim McVeigh was anything more than a stand-in or a fall guy in this whole deal. The second thing is the defense, I think, will try to sow the seeds of the concept that there was a conspiracy involved here, a neo-Nazi conspiracy at the bottom, and perhaps this neo-Nazi conspiracy reaches out to Germany, because the defense has at least one, if not a couple of individuals who are Germans, who come out of the German, or potentially come out of the German neo-Nazi movement, and who have been in the United States and who were, in fact, in Oklahoma. One of them was in Oklahoma, and to whom Tim McVeigh apparently made a telephone call shortly before all this happened. And then there's another possibility, international possibility, which Stephen Jones, the McVeigh attorney, is trying to develop, which is an a larger international plot. Sounds rather far-fetched, but he claims to have documentation that the Iraqis were somehow interested in this. And finally, the most interesting aspect of this whole thing is the possibility, which seems completely crazy on the surface, that the government itself had prior knowledge and may actually have been involved in some kind of a sting operation against the neo-Nazi movement, a sting that got out of control.
But Jim Ridgway, how does the government expect the American public to believe that McVeigh and Nichols acted alone when it itself initially put out this portrait of John Doe number 2? Whatever happened to John Doe number 2? And to what degree does the existence of a larger conspiracy play into a defense role for these the two accused?
Well, I think the government is sort of like kind of like lost it in a certain sense here, because I mean the government did indeed bring up the subject of John Doe number two, and then sort of like is going to have to say they couldn't find him, and the defense is now taking over all these conspiracy ideas and floating them so that the jury pool in Denver will certainly have read about the possibilities of a conspiracy, and even an international conspiracy. And what's a juror to do, after all? I mean, if this guy McVeigh appears to be a stand-in or fall guy or a little guy in some huge conspiracy plot, I mean, ought he to be put to death? I think you got to remember, all these attorneys are all death penalty attorneys. They're really looking here to the second phase in this case, which is they want to keep McVeigh from getting killed.
And in terms of the, you in some of your articles relate the civil suit that some of the victims have against McVeigh and Nichols, and the relationship between this Tulsa lawyer, Larry Oliver, and the defense attorneys. How are the plaintiffs in a civil suit involved in a relationship with the defense attorneys?
Well, it's a little like the OJ case. It's where you have this criminal suit, this criminal case, and then you have a civil case that's brought by, in this instance, by the grandfather of two of the dead children. He's brought the case against McVeigh. Now, this is a civil case, and they can do all sorts of discovery in a civil case, which you might not be able to do in a criminal case. And so these two cases, although they involve different attorneys and different sets of people, in a way work together to feed each other. And as I understand it, the judge in the criminal case has allowed Jones, the attorney for McVeigh in the criminal case, money to conduct an investigation to essentially defend McVeigh, not so much in the criminal case, but in the civil case, where so that Jones is able to go abroad. He's able to take trips abroad to look into the German question, the possibility that some right-wing Britons were involved in this, and so on. So these two cases kind of like work together. And the big thing, though, the really big thing, is that since McVeigh doesn't have any money, if the civil case were to be successful, if it were to turn into some sort of a class action kind of case on the basis of all these victims, it would have to be brought against the government. And, I mean, clearly the attorneys see the potential here, and so do the victims, of a Ruby Ridge multiplied by billions and billions. And if they can show in any way, shape, or form that there was prior knowledge by the government in this awful thing, they could stand to succeed.
Now, Jim, you talk about in your articles the United States government, the FBI, infiltrating the militia movement. Can you talk about that? And then how unlikely is it that the FBI might have known?
Well, I certainly am one who never took the prior knowledge thing very seriously. And when the John Birch people brought this up to begin with, I thought it was completely nuts. In other words, these are the people who are going around saying that the government blew up the building. I just thought that was a horrible kind of joke. But I must say, in the last couple of weeks, there's information that's been coming out that really raises some questions. There is a case in eastern Oklahoma in Muskogee called the Lampley case. Lampley was a guy who hung around Elohim City, which is a far-right community, Christian identity community down in eastern Oklahoma. And after Oklahoma City bomb, he came up with an idea of building his own bomb, and he was going to go off and kill Morris Dees and the Southern Poverty Law Center people in the ADL in Houston. He constructed this bomb, and he had, in the process of doing all this, an FBI informant, confidential informant, became involved with him and followed him. He then sought help to get explosives, and he sought it from the Tri-State Militia, a group in South Dakota. He talked to a guy named Parsons in the Tri-State Militia. Parsons is a former truck driver, and he was sort of the only guy, really, in this Tri-State Militia. He had a couple of fax machines. He had an 800 number, and he was connected to a whole lot of other militias. Well, in this trial of Lampley, which is now ongoing in Muskogee, Parsons testified. And he testified that his major source of income came every month in cash, of amount of $1,775, something like that, from the FBI. So he was a paid employee of the FBI. And the FBI denies that he's an informant. And yet Parsons has admitted on the stand that he took trips for the FBI to try to defuse some of these bomb plots that were going on. So, in fact, what we have here is an absolutely clear, cut and dried infiltration, penetration of the entire militia movement across the United States by the Federal Bureau of Investigation since the Oklahoma City bombing. And that then raises the question of, well, what was going on before? I mean, if they were able to do this with such ease afterwards, well, what were they doing before? Just one more point. I know this drags on, but you've got to remember that the FBI has methodically infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan and these right-wing groups since the 1940s. It has been in the it has pitted them against each other. Its informants, its agents have been very much involved. So it's really hard to believe, in fact, that there isn't some kind of infiltration of what it now is called the far right.
Well, I'd like to get our other guest, Todd Ensign, involved. Obviously, Timothy McVeigh was an Army veteran himself, and there was a recent report by the Department of Defense looking at the activity of extremist groups within the military that was issued in March, which basically discounts the possibility of extensive involvement of right-wing groups within our own armed forces. Todd, you've looked at that report and you've been studying this for some time. What's your reaction?
Well, Juan, the report was really necessitated by the murders of two black citizens down in Fayetteville in December. You recall that three white members of the 82nd Airborne went out and drove around Fayetteville at night looking randomly for victims, and they murdered these two young black, a man and a woman, on the streets of Fayetteville. That, of course, as it should, stirred enormous outrage, because these guys had been serving at the 82nd Airborne on Fort Bragg for a couple years. And one of the things that's come out in our investigation, Juan, is that the police, the local police, as well as the FBI, as well as Pennsylvania district attorneys, had been reporting consistently problems with these extremist skinheads on the base, attacks on college students, fights between the skinheads where people were shot. And this guy Burmeister, who's the principal defendant here, he had actually called up a local police chief in Pennsylvania and threatened his life and said, I'm an airborne ranger, and I can come off that base with any weapon I want and murder you. And yet the command did nothing. So what do we have here is an out-of-control situation on the base, which the command refused to do anything about. It results in terrible, heinous crimes. And now the military, the Army in this case, rushes in and says, let's take a look. Let's see what's happening. And what they said was, not much is happening.
But so they didn't conclude, though, that it was an isolated instance. They just said that the percentages or the numbers of soldiers who have been approached by extremist groups or been tempted to be recruited has been small. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, they said there was minimal evidence of right-wing extremist activity. That was their quote. I think they should read their own report more carefully. You know, these guys, these blue ribbon guys, they fly them in from somewhere. They sit around a room and have $12 sandwiches, and they tell them what the report says, and that's it. And that's a problem with this report. In fact, when they surveyed, they found that 17% of the people, 17,000 people surveyed, said that they had contact with extremist literature. To me, that's almost one out of five. I think that's alarming. There's 7% said they knew somebody who they believed was a member, or excuse me, was a right-wing extremist. These are very large figures, I think. And so Togo West's report really, I think, was intended to calm Congress, calm the American people. But in fact, I think it's a much deeper problem.
What about the paraphernalia on bases, the paraphernalia we associate with extreme right-wing groups, say a Confederate flag and things like that?
Well, you know, that Confederate flag issue has revived again, as you know. What I saw down there, I was down there last month, is they now have taken a twist on the Confederate flag. The bumper stickers now say things like, it has a Confederate flag, and then it says, the South was right. Now, I don't know exactly what that's supposed to mean. The other one has a Confederate flag flying over the Capitol building, and it says, I have a dream. So these bumper stickers are pretty common on base and off. They also sell right at the base entrance in these Army surplus stores manuals, Army manuals, incendiary devices, unconventional weapons, this sort of thing, are being sold. So any GI who has the slightest interest can clearly figure out how to make a fertilizer bomb.
And to either one of you, either Jim Ridgway or Todd Anson, what is the relationship then between this developing, this growing right-wing movement within the military and the civilian counterparts, in the general society?
Well, if I could just say for briefly, I mean, you know, the whole problem here is that the far right is not perceived as a political movement. It's thought of as a bunch of nuts or psychos, and the FBI has these behavioral scientists who try to psych out every one of them, you know. But it's actually a political movement. It's a nativist movement. It's been going on for an awfully long time. It's not only active in the military, it's active in the prisons. I mean, it's really active in the prison system. And it stretches now all across the country, from the West Coast down through the Ozarks. There's an actual white resistance, you know, people operating in cells. And everyone goes along and they say, oh, well, you know, just a few guys here and there. I mean, it's just like a failure to accept reality, if you ask me.
When I was doing some reporting on prison gangs of a couple of years ago, the Latin Kings and others, in interviewing federal officials and people who study gangs, the largest gang in the prisons of the United States are the Aryan Order gangs that are in almost every prison throughout the country.
Well, right after the Oklahoma bombing, in Fort Bragg, the National Alliance, which is one of the large far-right groups, and its head is a guy named Dr. William Pierce, who is the author of the Turner Diaries, which contains a scenario in which the FBI headquarters building is bombed with a fertilizer bomb at 9:15 in the morning. That's one of the little scenes in the book. That book is widely read, as Jim or anyone studies this knows. In fact, I believe McVeigh was believed to have a copy of the book. At any rate, the National Alliance put a billboard up at the entrance to Fort Bragg saying, if you want more information about our group, call this toll-free number. This was after the Oklahoma bombings. Now, again, I don't want to see too many conspiracies here, but these folks are hard at work at outreaching. One in five of the people the West Commission polled said, yeah, I've had contact with extremist literature. How many people in New York have seen extremist literature in the last year? I don't think 17%.
Todd, is it true that the Canadian government is reconsidering its military relationship, at least as far as sending soldiers to Fort Bragg to train?
Yes, that has become a big issue in Canada. The Canadian Airborne Regiment had trained down there for years. By the way, many, many Special Forces units from all over the world train at Fort Bragg. Fort Bragg is the world's center for Special Forces operations. And one of the things the West Report said was that the Special Forces is in danger of becoming an all-white organization. There are very few minorities in the Special Forces and also in the combat arms in general. And so you see a trend here, which even the West people were concerned about. So the Canadians have said, we're not sure we can allow this kind of operation. The Airborne Regiment went off to Somalia. They murdered, one of them they did on videotape, they murdered five or six Somalian citizens.
The Canadians.
The Canadian Airborne Regiment. And this, in Canada, I think it's a good sign, caused such a stir that they have now disbanded that regiment.
Jim Ridgway. Go ahead, Mon.
No, I was just going to ask Jim, in terms of the continuing growth of the, you're saying that the country is not regarding this as a political movement. Do you think that following the Oklahoma bombing, that this has actually created a spurt or a further growth of the militia and right wing movement, or do you think that more and more people have been turned off and realized the increasing danger of this movement?
No, I think it's really strange. I think it's encouraged and increased it. I mean, who would have thought that the concept that the government blew up its own building would be taken seriously? I mean, it's really hard to grasp this, but this is going to become, in one way or another, a plank, a basic bottom in this trial, in the defense of this trial, and it's going to be discussed in some detail. I never would have thought that. I think the far right has been extraordinarily successful in building since the 1980s, both an overground, an above ground political apparatus, and an underground. I mean, you see, this underground was busted. The order was locked up and busted, but then they went to the cell structure, to the leaderless resistance cells, and it seems to me they've been quite successful.
How successful has the government been in prosecuting far-right groups involved with violence?
Well, the government has, you know, a pretty horrible record here. I mean, they tried to bring cases during the Second World War, Roosevelt tried to crack down, and they just disintegrated into farces. There was a seditious conspiracy case that the government brought against the leaders of the far right at the end of the 1980s, which was lost.
I mean, which group?
See, the far right is made up of all these different little groups, put together in a movement. So they brought a case against the leaders on a conspiracy case. Miles and Butler, Louis Beam, several of these better known people, and the government lost the case. And in fact, it was in that case that one of the snitches, who'd been a leader in the movement, said that they had been planning to blow up the Oklahoma City federal building. And, you know, the case was such a disaster that one of the jurors married one of the defendants in this case. And currently, then the Weaver thing happened, and who knows what
it'll Ridge.
Do.
Well, Jim Ridgway, Todd Ensign, they're our guests, and we're going to come back to them. Jim Ridgway, writer for The Village Voice, has been covering the far right, is author of the book Blood in the Face, as well as the documentary by that title. Todd Ensign is with Citizen Soldier, a GI veterans' rights advocacy organization. When we come back, we're going to bring this specifically to the presidential campaign and to one Patrick Buchanan. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in Washington with Juan Gonzalez in New York. Although Pat Buchanan's presidential bid has essentially failed, he isn't pulling out of the race just yet, and some of his diehard supporters are still hopeful that he'll be able to have a serious impact on the 1996 election, at least on the GOP platform. With his America First and anti-federal government rhetoric, few are surprised to hear that Buchanan has received support from Second Amendment fundamentalists, including members of militias. Pacifica reporter Philip Babich recently spoke with Buchanan supporters at a campaign whistle stop in Pinole, California. We're going to hear what they have to say and then get reaction from our guests Jim Ridgway and Todd Ensign.
Let me tell you what this campaign is all about and why we're going to go. When you say go, Pat, go, I tell you, I take your message. That means we ought to go all the way to San Diego. Isn't that right? We're not stopping. We're not slowing down because we got a cause, friends. It's all about a lot more than a single man. It is a cause of putting our own country first for a change. And we got to take back our party first, and then we take back our country.
I support Pat Buchanan because he's against GATT and NAFTA, and he's fiery. He's not a wimp like all the others, and I'm 100% behind him. And everything that he says, I'm 100% behind him.
I'm just here to support the political process. I mean, I'm not old enough to vote. I won't be able to vote for the president, but I'm just here to be a part of the political process, you know, to show that youth, you know, we have a voice too, and just to be heard. And it is a rare opportunity for us in Pinole to get a chance to see someone as important as Mr. Buchanan. I mean, this is a working class town, and we support them here. So keep the jobs in America. Us first.
He's a very strong man that has a very great future ahead of him. And if anybody can turn this rotten country that we have now around, it's him.
You know, what are they doing back in Washington? Selling out the sovereignty for which the founding fathers fought and died. I mean, what are they doing cutting trade deals that surrender our authority over our foreign trade to some ridiculous World Trade Organization in Geneva where we get one vote out of 120? What are they doing? means subordinating our interest to those of the United Nations again and again and again.
If we get out of the UN, that's all we need. The rest will be okay. We got to get out of the United Nations. And all the other talk doesn't mean much because they're beating around the bush. You got to get to the point.
So you're concerned then that if the United States continues its involvement with the United Nations is what will turn into the one world government?
One world government. We'll all be under their rule. They'll have their own money. We won't have money anymore. They'll take everything. I mean, they'll be the boss. They'll run our country the way they want to run it. We have to do what they say, and I'm against that. Absolutely. And they're not telling the public about the UN. Pat's the only one. He's got the guts to tell the public about it.
What is it about the UN that's to fear?
The UN is a one-world government under one rule. And all the big ones are going to be running it.
Who would you consider the big ones, the bigger countries?
No, the ones that are high up. Even Dole and a lot of the establishment. Yeah, and Gingrich is in on it from what I understand, and there's some that are even higher up. I've ordered a book which will give me the name of the 10 top people that are going to control it.
There will be such a revolution, one world will never take over, never. People are too alert now, they're not as stupid as they used to be.
I basically like his tax positions. You know, his positions on gun control. All we need is more bloody gun control. I mean, California's had worse, more stringent gun laws for years, and what is there, no crime here?
He still is the one promoting family values and also against abortion. That's the main thing.
If the pro-life plank doesn't survive through the convention, the Republican Party will be so split that it will never survive.
And we're going to make sure the wafflers don't get their way. Because I'm going into that hall and I'm going to stand up bravely and boldly for the right to life. And we're going to keep Ronald Reagan's right to life plank in that Republican platform.
Evidently, what the media is saying about him, calling him an extremist and things like that, it doesn't work because what the people take that is they're calling them that. And they aren't. They're just, they love the freedom and they love their country.
My goal, if everybody asks, they say, what do you want to do, Pat? I say, I'd like to be able to help hand down to the next generation of Americans a country that was as great and good as one my parents gave to me. Thank you all very much, and God bless you.
Pat Buchanan for president. Pat Buchanan for president. Well, if you want to find out where the money went from, Pat Buchanan for president.
And thank you for that piece, Philip Babish, Jim Ridgway, your reaction to some of the themes that clearly people around the country are picking up on of Pat Buchanan's.
Well, I've spent some time recently in Oklahoma, and I can just tell you that the Klan guys there, Gary, have, you know, Buchanan bumper stickers. And James Nichols, Terry's brother, he has Pat Buchanan's standards in his house.
Has Pat Buchanan's what?
Standards, you know, signs that he puts out on the roadside. He supports Pat Buchanan. And so what you have is, I think, all across, like the far right, a kind of gathering towards Buchanan, a fond feeling for him in many, many different respects. That's not to say that all the people that support Buchanan are racist or something, but there certainly are a considerable number of them.
And how does Pat Buchanan use this? I mean, do you think he's aware of it?
He plays to the nativist movement. He's a nativist candidate. I mean, this whole far-right movement is a nativist American movement. It's been around here for ages and ages, and nobody pays any attention to it, but Pat Buchanan plays to it. And he draws, you know, in some of those states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and so forth, 30%. That's where it's at. That's what it's about. That's the kind of numbers you're looking at when you talk about, if you're going to look at nativism as a political movement, like people look at populism or progressivism or something, if you're going to look at the nativist movement, that's what it amounts to.
How is the militia movement going to figure into the election year?
Well, the FBI has been attempting to sit down with the militia guys and talk about bombing places and shooting people and encouraging them, I gather, to go into politics. At least in Michigan, that's the case, where they all have lunch every week. So I don't know.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Todd Ensign, in terms of the relationship between the extremists in the military and the broader right-wing political movement? What's your gauge on what some of the stuff that Jim Ridgway is saying in relationship to the military? And
well, one thing's pretty clear with our current president. He has a completely hands-off policy towards the military. Anything the military says, anything it wants to do, is fine with him, and that's probably because of this fear he has of being seen as a painted once again as a draft dodger. So they haven't done a thing about the eroding equal opportunity environment within the military, which the Dellums Committee had reported a year earlier before the murders. That hasn't been a concern. You've got these gung-ho, elitist, hell-for-leather type special forces units. They breed a mentality which leads to this kind of stuff. And I think, as I said earlier, the National Alliance and other groups realize that guys like McVeigh, guys like Burmeister are real cannon fodder for them. They're just naturally going to appeal to them because they have that simplistic right, black and white mentality about every issue in the world.
But how would that spill over into, let's say, the presidential race and presidential politics?
Well, I don't think, as far as the two main candidates, it really will, because Dole clearly is willing to give the military anything they ask for, anything they want. You know, with all these cuts, the military budget is growing, and the Republicans want to give them even more. So I don't think it'll really enter in there. But what will happen is if we have more of this kind of thing, these killings, this racial extremists acting out, then you will see Clinton may be forced to actually do something about this and tell his commanders they've got to put a stop to this kind of extremism in the ranks.
Jim Ridgway and Todd Ensign, we want to thank you very much for joining us again. Jim Ridgway, a writer for The Village Voice, has also written the book Blood in the Face and has done films on the right wing in this country and the militia movement. Todd Ensign is with Citizen Soldier, a GI veterans rights advocacy organization, and he has a piece in the forthcoming Covert Action Quarterly. And if you like to get a copy of the Covert Action Quarterly, you can call 202-331-9763. That's 202-331-9763. Thank you, Jim and Todd, for joining us. Well, I think this segment moves right into the next one, because the House yesterday sent President Clinton a major so-called counterterrorism bill in time for today's anniversary of the Oklahoma bombing. The bill passed 293-133 after clearing the Senate 91-8. The bill provides $1 billion for anti-terrorism efforts at the state and federal level over 4 years and requires chemical tagging of plastic explosives so that they can be traced if they're used in bombings. First, we're going to go to one of the people who objected to aspects of the bill, and he's Democrat Mel Watt of North Carolina.
Mr. Hyde, I'm sure, will admit that there's a provision in this bill that allows the consideration of secret evidence that the defendant will never even know about and can never refute. That is absolutely counter to everything that our country stands for.
And again, that was Democrat Mel Watt of North Carolina. We're joined in the studio by Kit Gage, who's the Washington director of the National Committee Against Repressive Legislation, known as NCARL. It's a Los Angeles-based civil rights group which was under FBI surveillance for 30 years. They sued the government, got an injunction against the FBI, forever monitoring them again. And you've been very active, Kit, fighting this bill. Can you first respond to the part of the bill that Mel Watt was just talking about? What are these secret trials?
Sure. Let me just describe this as a part of a larger thing. A lot of people get kept out of this country or kicked out of this country in ways that are new or that harken back to the anti-communist era. People could get kicked out. People who are here legally, immigrants who are here legally, could be kicked out of the country not because they've committed a crime, but because their politics are unpopular. They would be kicked out using secret evidence that they would be unable to see, unable to rebut. They wouldn't be able to confront their accuser. And being that they're in this country, that process has been upheld by the courts as completely illegal thus far, so this would be a big change. As well, people would be kept out of the country, not allowed to come into the country because of their membership in an organization and or because they don't have documents to let them in, which would affect adversely torture victims.
Wait, so this legislation allows for these secret trials where you've got, say, an ex-husband who wants you out of the country, so says you're part of a terrorist organization, you don't know who your accuser is, you don't know what they're accusing you of, and you can be deported?
That's exactly right. In fact, there have been those kinds of cases. cases where disgruntled family members have tried to kick other people out of the country. And in fact, the case in Los Angeles called the LA 8 case, which is sort of the most direct evidence of this kind of activity by the government spent years trying to get people out of the country simply because of their membership in organizations.
And they were Palestinian.
Primarily Palestinian, one Kenyan.
Are there any other provisions of the bill? I've been told that, for instance, in habeas corpus and in other areas, that the bill is also a growing repressive direction in government.
Absolutely. The whole bill is a mishmash of anti-crime provisions that the government's been trying to pass for many years. It's not really an anti-terrorism bill. It's an anti-dissent bill. You mentioned habeas. That basically affects people, poor and minority people's right to appeal once they're in prison, to appeal to the federal courts.
And in fact, of course, a lot of people are simply saying that that is the main point of this bill, is to limit death penalty appeals in particular. And we're going to talk about that issue on Monday with the head of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Today, we wanted to focus on these other aspects that might get a little lost with the focus on the death penalty. What are some of those other anti-terrorism, as they're called, parts of the bill?
To expose how bizarre this is, I mean, one of the anti-terrorist provisions is to not allow people to donate money to legal humanitarian activities that are in areas of conflict around the world. If you give that kind of money to orphanages, to schools, if the groups that are working on that are remotely affiliated with what the U.S. government has decided and has labeled terrorist groups, then you are committing a crime by giving money to those kind of groups, like the African National Congress, like the activity that Central America activists were doing perfectly legally a few years back.
I don't understand. What can a bank do?
No, this doesn't have to do with banks, this provision, so much. It's that the government, you, an individual, are committing a crime by giving money to an orphanage that has some relationship to it.
So the government can arrest you.
That's right.
The government can deport you.
No, the government, can deport you, or if you're a U.S. citizen, they can throw you in jail and fine you.
What about?
In other words, if you were selling raffles for NORAD or contributing money to a humanitarian group that might have been linked to Hamas or some Palestinian group, that they could declare that to be a crime.
And the remote can be that link can be very remote. That's right. Mm-hmm.
And what about the banks? I was just looking at some memos of the American Civil Liberties Union. They were writing to Congress about this, what seems to be one of the most outrageous aspects of this bill.
Right. It, in a somewhat related provision, banks get to decide. In fact, are urged to decide, and because of a threat of a fine if they don't, that they should freeze the assets of domestic, quote, agents of designated terrorist groups, and the banks have to decide what is an agent. So you've got people who are not members of people in the United States who are not members of a designated terrorist group, who may be involved in some of that fundraising activity for humanitarian aid. The bank has the obligation to freeze the assets of those individuals or organizations if they decide that there's a remote link to that group.
But now we have financial institutions deciding if you are a so-called terrorist or linked to one. I mean, you've got an official list of terrorist organizations that the U.S. government gives out. That's pretty clear. If one of these organizations signs up with a bank, they can say, no, we don't take your bank account, or they'll freeze their assets. But what if you're not officially with one of these groups? The bank investigates you or decides and then gets penalized if they end up having a bank account of yours and they don't freeze it?
That's correct. And in addition, if the bank makes a clear mistake, there's no provision for appealing that decision. There is no provision for unfreezing those assets. It's the provision is very much an example of the sausage-making process that especially happens in a conference. It looks like a clear mistake. I mean, that's the only way to explain that there would be absolutely no appeal process in this provision.
Well, Kit, given the extensive draconian measures in this bill, why did it pass by 91-8 in the Senate and so overwhelmingly in the House?
Political pressure. This bill has been very well marketed, despite the efforts of people that I've been working with in a very bizarre broad coalition. It's been well marketed as a terrorist bill to try to deal with Oklahoma City. And instead of being a Band-Aid on the wounds of Oklahoma City, it ends up being a tourniquet on the First Amendment.
So we're talking about a coalition from the NRA to the Quakers that oppose this.
That's right. And it's been wonderful fun in some senses, because we've been able to bring a number of right-wing groups nationally, but also activists around the country from the right as well as the left, organized around the right to dissent, and not organized around gun rights so much, but really around the key rights to dissent, around peaceful dissent, and how this bill attacks that.
Well, Kit Gage, we want to thank you very much for joining us. And again, on Monday, we're going to continue this discussion with the head of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, because this so much limits death row appeals of prisoners. Kit Gage is Washington Director of the National Committee Against Repressive Legislation, known as NCARL, based in L.A. And we want to thank you for joining us. Democracy Now! Was produced by Julie Drizin with help from Pat Greenfield. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason in Washington, Matthew Finch in New York, with help from Errol Maitland. If you'd like a copy of the show, the number to call is 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can write to us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!